London's burning. That was the headline that went around the world when for several nights in August, the British capital and several other big cities descended into chaos and fear. Exactly 1 year on, London hosted the glittering spectacle of the Olympic Games, which had been praised for their friendliness. So, were the rioters just a blip? A random outpouring of anger sustained for nights on end by the lure of opportunistic looting? Or were they more deeply rooted than that? Did they in fact have a political edge? Could chaos come again to the capital? To answer that, we must understand what happened and why. Whatever the underlying causes of the riots, there is no doubt as to what the trigger was. On Thursday, the 4th of August 2011, armed police stopped a minicab to arrest Tottenham resident Mark Duggan. Exactly what happened next is still unclear, even 1 year on. But shots were fired, and Mark Duggan wound up dead. David Akinsanya lives a stone's throw from where Mark Duggan died and was quickly on the scene.
Well, I saw the helicopter land, rushed over there with my camera, and it wasn't quite cordoned off then. The police were standing in places trying to keep people back off of the rise of the bridge. And I was sort of craning my neck trying to get photographs, chatting to a few people who were there. And I got chatting to one guy who said to me, he heard four shots. He heard lots of shouting and then he heard four shots. I actually had an errand to run, so I went off and came back and then took more photographs because the road was still closed. And by this time there was a cordon up and all I could see was the vehicle surrounded by other cars and an ambulance right next to it. I knew something big had happened because they never keep that road closed like that for 48. I think it was more than 48 hours they kept that road shut. And there was lots of rumours going around about what had happened. I was trying to find out from people, what did you hear, what did you see? And a lot of people said that they just heard shouting and shots.
The police's handling of the aftermath of this event would prove disastrous. At first, they heavily implied that Duggan had fired on the police as they announced that there was a bullet lodged in the radio of one of their officers.
There was definitely tension the next day. In fact, I think there was that the IPCC put out a statement saying that there'd been an exchange of fire. And because of what I heard the day before, I didn't believe that. And because of what I'd heard from people who said they'd seen what happened, I didn't believe that. But there was certainly a lot of rumours flying about. I mean, rumours, you know, i.e. that he was executed, that he didn't draw a gun, that he was on the floor, you know, all these sorts of things. And these were being talked about in Tottenham. And, you know, people are upset about it.
Mark Duggan's family felt that they were not told enough by the police and the Independent Police Complaints Commission. The IPCC is responsible for investigating deaths in custody and took over the investigation into Mark's death the day after it happened.
This issue about deaths in custody has been played up for years about the correct guidelines, the correct procedures, what you need to do to support a family. None of that seemed to apply in the case of Mark Duggan's family, and they were left without that support because it was unclear between the police and the IPCC who was going to provide that support and who was going to provide the information that clearly the family needed and the public also needed. And there was a clear information vacuum. And in that process of an information vacuum, other stories started to emerge.
The silence of the authorities allowed anger to build in the community and set events in motion. On Saturday, a peaceful protest led by Duggan's friends and family marched through the area to Tottenham's police station. They were trying to get the attention of the police and get answers as to exactly what circumstances led to Mark's death.
This family arrived there at 4 o'clock. They were there till 8 o'clock, still with no senior person coming to attend to them. And so that is a very patient family to be there for that length of time and still not get any information or answers. And, you know, in that moment when they turned away after all of that and went back home, the crowd was building a momentum.
I understand why they were angry when they were told that no one was coming out to talk to them. But it seemed that things exploded when a young 16-year-old girl approached the police line and was in their faces and was pushed over. And that's when the crowd started to get angry.
The crowd began to attack the police and set fire to their patrol vehicles. The situation was rapidly getting out of hand.
Well, by the time I got there, the mood was bad. I mean, there were about 40 kids with hoods up, masked faces, charging at the police. And they were calling the crowd to come with them. But as I said, most of the crowd were actually bystanders. They weren't there for trouble. And very few people did come forward with them. So it was mainly this group of 30 to 50 young people who kept charging at the police. The police weren't charging back. They were running forward 10 paces and running back. There were 15 of these riot officers standing between the crowd of 300 and the police station. And it just seemed really inadequate to me. I mean, I didn't feel like there was any control there.
A bus trying to come down the road was attacked and set alight. Businesses and homes were attacked, some broken into, some burnt. Tottenham's main high street became a scene of chaos that lasted long into the night. As time wore on, the rioters became more focused on looting than attacking the police. The rioters had realised that there simply weren't enough officers to stop them from breaking into businesses and taking whatever they wanted.
You just get the feeling that it was out of hand. You get the feeling that they could have stopped an awful lot of that violence. They could have stopped what went on to happen the following nights, because I'm sure that people were inspired to come out on the streets by the fact they'd seen people in Tottenham get away with it.
This building was so badly burnt that it had to be demolished the next day. It housed a carpet business downstairs, but there were 26 residential flats above it. It wasn't only businesses that suffered losses in this first night of troubles. On Sunday, word spread about how successful the looting had been. And by the evening, gangs of masked men were appearing in various areas of London, breaking into shops and taking all that they could carry. Clashes with police spread to more areas. More rocks were thrown, more cars burnt. The situation was escalating again, but this was nothing compared to Monday night. On Monday, arson, looting and violence spread to almost every area of London. The police put every man and woman at their disposal on the street, from the most experienced veterans to the newest recruits, but it was still not enough. Often the police were overwhelmed, but even when they had superior numbers, the looters would simply melt away into the alleyways and side streets, looking for easier targets to attack. For every riot that the police did manage to disperse, there seemed to be five more, bigger, more violent and more determined, that the boys in blue were powerless against. The unrest began to spread beyond London. England's second city, Birmingham, saw similar scenes with other small-scale incidents in other English cities and towns. The most dramatic clashes were in the capital, though. The images that went round the world were of London burning. The next morning, both the Prime Minister and the Mayor of London had rushed back to the capital from their holidays. David Cameron immediately sought to take a firm grasp of the situation and dissuade any further trouble.
I've also met with the Metropolitan Police Commissioner and the Home Secretary to discuss this further. And people should be in no doubt that we will do everything necessary to restore order to Britain's streets and to make them safe for the law-abiding.
As I said, I drove past the shop.
Tuesday night in London saw only small disturbances. The riots had run their course in the capital. But further north in Manchester, the looting continued. And in Birmingham, three men out on the streets protecting their community paid with their lives when they were run down by a car.
The people who committed the murder, they deliberately did not like the protectors. Okay, the looters did not like the protectors, and that's why they came to attack them.
Meanwhile, the death that led to the riots was becoming yet more controversial. A week after Mark Duggan died, the police had to acknowledge that there had not been an exchange of fire. The bullet lodged in a police officer's radio was from another officer's gun. No reason was given for why the police opened fire. The IPCC has been investigating for a year and still has not delivered a report. As disturbances died down during the week, the police retook control. Using CCTV footage, they identified looters and rioters and began breaking down their doors. 1 week after the first violence in Tottenham, the police had made over 1,000 arrests in London alone. And 600 of those were charged that same week. The fear generated among the public during the nights of chaos soon became anger in the aftermath. Calls were made for the harshest possible sentences to be doled out. The overriding cry was to show no mercy to those who had so maliciously torn communities apart.
Well, we know for a fact that on average the sentences that have been handed down to the rioters are about 25% higher than normal. We also know for a fact that 2 out of 3 of those appearing in the magistrates' courts are being remanded into custody prior to their full trial. That compares with a normal 10%. So something is clearly happening. Magistrates are 6 times more likely to remand these people in prison before their trial and seem to be giving out longer sentences than normal. Now, that's up to the magistrates. They claim that they are dealing with each case on its merits.
You know, there is due process in the justice system. The justice system is influenced by public debate, it's influenced by the media, it's influenced to some extent, though not directly politically, by what politicians say. But the system itself, there is due process.
The courts worked 24 hours a day in the aftermath of the unrest to deliver speedy justice. But this left many of the convictions vulnerable to appeal, amid accusations that the court's proceedings were not as thorough as they should have been, particularly late at night.
People keep talking about we need to send out a message. Well, I think the problem is the message being sent out is that with people like you, whoever you might be, we don't really care so much about consistency. We just want to really answer the mob's demand for justice.
And the so-called mob was making its wishes known loud and clear.
This is our era, not your...
3 days after the worst night of trouble, an e-petition on the government's website advocating the removal of convicted rioters' benefits had attracted the 100,000 signatures necessary to warrant the attention of Parliament. This sparked a national debate over whether rioters should lose their right to social housing as well.
This is just the wrong way of going around it. If someone does something wrong, you punish them in the way the law normally punishes them. We shouldn't sort of mix up the benefit system and the justice system. I think probably we need to keep those separate.
The notion of taking people's houses and money away when they live in poor accommodation and haven't got much money anyway is a recipe for more crime, and I hope it just doesn't see light today. But with this government, who knows?
The idea of taking away benefits did soon die away as the inherent problems with such a measure were discussed more and more. But young rioters' convictions will haunt them long after they're freed. So just what did provoke such a sudden, violent outpouring from so many people? Almost immediately, left-wing commentators were trying to explain away the rioters' actions, much to the ire of some public figures, such as the Mayor of London.
What about the... It is time that people who are engaged in looting and violence stopped hearing economic and sociological justifications.
I don't think the riots can be justified. They can't be justified at all. Burning people's livelihoods and homes is not on, and that needs to be addressed. And they need to be punished, speaking very frankly. But at the same time, we need to look at the causes of this situation.
It's too simplistic to say that this is just about criminality. I think we do have to scratch beneath the surface, and we do have to examine what's beneath. And we do have to talk about issues of poverty, and we do have to talk about societal divide and inequality. And, you know, we do have to talk about what has happened to communities and what and whether or not communities are resilient enough in times when things are tough.
For us, it's about engaging with young people, talking to us and actually finding out the reasons why we thought the riot started, rather than it just all being think tanks and MPs and local councillors telling us why the riot started. And when we surveyed the young people, we actually found that 2/3 of them thought that the reason the young people were there were just a chance to get free stuff. And I think that goes back to this idea around deprivation in the areas where the riots were caused. Over half thought it was down to poor parenting and a lack of respect of right and wrong. So I think, echoing the general public's views, there are many reasons why these riots started, and young people felt that these were the three that were most prevalent.
Look, I was a juvenile offender. I was a young person. I remember what it was like. And I'm saying to you honestly that I could have got caught up in the hype of what was going on. People were getting messages telling them there was a revolution. People were getting messages saying that, you know, this is our opportunity to take on the police. It was very well coordinated, and I suspect that I would have probably got caught up in that hype and probably would have been out doing what they were doing. But I was an uncontrollable child, and I didn't have anybody to tell me off. And I think that's probably the same for a lot of these children. They saw an opportunity. They saw young people supposedly get away with it the night before, and they took that opportunity. When you're young, you don't necessarily think about the full consequences.
The motivation that commentators have tended to ascribe to the rioters is that they were railing against how unfair society is to them. The central pillar of that unfairness being how the government cut measures designed to help the downtrodden, whilst letting bankers go unpunished for the financial crisis. Unemployment, unsurprisingly, is a big problem in many of the areas that rioters came from.
We can't say for certain, but what is definitely clear is that when you have high unemployment, you have more social unrest, and that's been proven in, you know, countries around the world. It's not a given, but it certainly increases the likelihood of that happening. And I think we have to say that, you know, that may well have played a part.
I think there's no doubt for me that the economic crisis and the high unemployment is a big factor within why the riots happened. And I think that the government does have to answer to be able to try and solve some of those problems. In Hackney, for example, it's one of the areas where it's most difficult to find work, and there's 29 applicants for every job going. If you're in those areas, again, frustration's going to be formed.
And when you look at the type of young people that offended last summer, it was mainly young people that weren't particularly academic or going down that route of high-flying young people. These were young people that are going to stay in the city, looking for work, looking to do something with their time, do something with their giftings and their energies, but the opportunities aren't there.
The riots were not an organised political protest. They were born out of anger. But one of the many factors that caused that anger was the austerity policies the government has chosen to stick to. Many feel that the politics of government cuts must be addressed when talking about why the riots happened.
But we're seeing widespread cuts across the country, and local authorities are finding it very easy to be able to cut youth services because young people aren't able to vote, they're not able to speak up about the issues. And what we've found, as well as the time, is that there's negative stereotypes of young people in and around communities. And it reinforces this message that maybe we don't need to invest in young people, when actually, when we invest in young people, we find that they create better communities and they're actually better leaders.
The youth service, youth provisions that young people use, they're all being cut to detrimental means. I don't think young people went out on the streets and were saying to themselves, because of the cuts, I am going to riot. But I do think there is a link between the two, one that perhaps hasn't fully been realised yet.
Few people attribute a single driving cause to the riots. For example, no one puts the blame purely upon the parliamentary expenses scandal, the government's bailout of the banks, or the media phone hacking scandal. But some do say that this culture of immorality among the country's elite contributed to the alienation of those who lashed out.
Within those areas of deprivation where the riots took place, when you look at politicians getting away to an extent with spending more than they should and claiming stuff they shouldn't, when you see bankers throwing money away, and the media acting immoral, I think it's easy to go, well, you know, why can't I be immoral as well? I'm not necessarily sure it's the reason the riot started, but I think it will play a role within people's psyches at the time about how they feel their places in society.
These major institutions have been badly damaged in the eyes of the public. But the institution that has a particularly difficult relationship with areas like Tottenham is the police. In deprived areas, the police routinely stop and search young people, especially black boys, as part of their tactics to stop gun and knife crime. These frequent searches have become extremely frustrating for innocent people who are searched just because the way they look or dress matches what the police think young criminals look like. Young people increasingly see the police as the enemy, describing them as just another gang.
We really need to come to the grips with this problem about people getting shot within our community. We need to come to grips with the idea that young people are going to be searched, so we need to train them, and we need to make sure that when that happens to them, they understand why it's happening, it's fair. You know, we never used to get a slip of paper and ask our solicitor inform when I was a kid, you were bunged in the back of a van, taken to the police station, disappeared for 3 days, and you turn up and you tell everybody where you were. That's not the case anymore. You know, young people have got more rights and have got more, ways of, confronting what the law does to them.
Clearly on the ground, the relationship is not good. The fact that you can have standoffs in public, in open air, between the police and young people, where the police are in full riot gear and yet being hammered, being beaten by sticks, stones, whatever people could find, it was seen. Police vehicles being destroyed in full daylight. You know, people operating without any fear of authority, any fear of the police, almost as though they see it as an opportunity to get their own back. Well, what is it that they're getting back? How is it that they've come to this position in this relationship with the police? Who have the police been talking to all this time when they said that they've been building the relationship with the community where they say they've learned from 1980? Clearly, they've not developed those relationships on the ground with people, and young people in particular, who are probably living on the edge of society anyway.
Since the riots, there has been a greater effort that has been made to invest in neighbourhood policing. But you can't just legislate that. I think it's the building of trust relationally that will take time.
The police has a greater role now in trying to be able to stop the riots happening again, and that is all about how they interact with everybody in the community, not just those people who feel they need protecting the most, but also those people who feel like they're being disadvantaged and those people who feel like they're being targeted as, you know, your typical person who will cause trouble. Police need to be involved with them as well, and I think they are making steps to be able to do that.
Undoubtedly, the police-community relationship in areas like Tottenham is better now than it was in the 1980s, when police brutality and racism caused extremely vicious and deadly riots. That said, the current relationship could hardly be described as warm or friendly. It remains tense. This is not footage from the London riots. This is footage from student protests against a rise in university tuition fees. A minority of the protesters attacked the headquarters of the ruling Conservative Party. This occurred in 2010, a year before the riots. More student marches and protests followed, with small numbers of protesters engaging in vandalism and violence each time. Although that violent minority was mostly denounced as troublemakers hijacking peaceful, legitimate protests, perhaps their showing of politicised violence served as an example to some who rioted the following year. The peaceful majority on these marches were protesting against the government's approach to the deficit, raising fees and cutting benefits. This was the first major public display of this sentiment, which would grow over the following years. The message was gradually becoming more well-defined. During 2011, more and more voices began piping up, talking about the need for systemic change in Britain's political and financial systems.
If this system can't afford to give us jobs, can't afford to give us an education or give us a future, then we've got to change that system, and we've got to fight for a new system that is going to be run and serve the interests of the vast majority of people in society.
Capitalism has not always been like this. If you cast your mind back to the 1960s, capitalism was, first of all, much more responsible. It was creating better jobs, sustainable jobs. It was much more productive than the current version we have now. The idea that capitalism has always been like this is misfounded. What we have at the moment is a capitalism that, by and large, is predatory. It uses our savings, our pension funds and so on, to gamble largely on the global markets rather than to create proper jobs. It's not very productive. It's long overdue for a complex overhaul.
We want not only a few politicians to change their minds over this or that issue, but ultimately we want system change. We want change that ultimately means that we have affordable housing, that we aren't being harassed on the streets when we walk home from school and being stopped and searched, that we ultimately have free education, and we have all those things that our parents' generation had, and that the politicians that are in charge and are making us pay for an economic crisis we didn't create also had. And so this won't be simply brought about by some politicians opening avenues for young people to discuss and talk with them, but ultimately this will come through movements from below, like the students' movement, or like Indignados in Spain, or like the protesters in Greece.
I mean, our demands are actually very reasonable. You know, the demand for free education, demands for decent training schemes and apprenticeships for young people, for a programme of public works and nationalisation to save and protect jobs. They're all reasonable demands, but the problem is they're not going to be met because we have a political system that's completely tailored to the needs of big business and maximising the profits of the tiny minority of super rich people.